wildfires raging out of control in California.
As California burns again, we ask, do the prevailing media narratives serve us?
We really need to start framing this differently. I mean, I despair that our contemporary politics can in any way deal with the challenge that this century presents us.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. After being linked to a series of mass shootings, hate site 8chan is in exile. And that's where the activists wanted to stay.
If 8chan comes back, it's only a matter of time before there is another 8chan-connected shooting.
And in one newsroom, journalists struggle with the responsibility of deciding who gets to be forgotten on the internet.
Every month, I'd get more of these requests from somebody saying, your story is wrecking my life, imploring you to help them overcome a mistake.
It's all coming up after this. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone with this news alert. California is on fire.
A dangerous wildfire is threatening hundreds of homes in Los Angeles near the world-famous Getty Center.
In the north, a Kincade fire, so big it looks like this. This is 85 miles away in San Francisco.
California's governor has declared a statewide emergency.
And then the placing of blame. Quick and dirty construction of homes in fire-prone areas, climate change, and of course, the electrical utility Pacific Gas and Electric.
This morning, Pacific Gas and Electric blacking out about 1.5 million people in 30 counties to prevent high winds from toppling power lines and sparking new fire.
Dion and Dan, these documents were just filed with the California Public Utilities Commission today. They outline how those two fires that happened in Lafayette could be tied again to PG&E power lines.
We've now learned that PG&E equipment may be to blame.
It's here, on the subject of blame, says writer Quinn Norton, where we lose the forest for the burning trees. As she wrote on emptywheel.net this month, when you zoom further and further out, what you begin to see is an all-encompassing crisis of technical debt.
So technical debt is a term largely used in software development when you talk about doing the quick and dirty and not really figuring out what things need to look like in the long term. The classic example of technical debt is the Y2K bug.
Mm-hmm.
The quick and dirty there was that they used two spots for the year instead of four. So when the year 2000 came up, everything was going to reset to being 1900 instead of 2000. And computers need to know what time it is. They need to know the date in order to function. So all of a sudden, they were going to time travel in the wrong direction.
And this was because they simply kicked the can of a problem they knew was going to come down the road. The sky didn't fall, but that doesn't mean there wasn't the possibility that it might.
Oh, yeah. It could have really stopped our infrastructure. But we pulled together all over the world and put in billions of dollars, millions of man hours, and largely fixed it. And things didn't fall apart. But I think people kind of think it was overblown when it wasn't. It was fixed. It was a great moment for society.
So you argue that technical debt isn't just an apt metaphor for the wildfire crisis, but really refers to a kind of global infrastructure problem.
Yes. Infrastructure is the way we engineer the world. And when we do it fast and dirty, when we do it in a way that works now without an eye towards what's going to happen in the long run, we're building up technical debt in exactly the same way we did with something like Y2K, exactly the same way we do now when we build computer systems or your phone or anything like that that just doesn't work as well as it should.
In the case of the wildfire, the infrastructure problem was that people built homes out of materials that weren't appropriate, regulations weren't followed.
Or regulations didn't exist.
What about the wide-ranging criticism of Pacific Gas and Electric? It was their lines that in some cases sparked these wildfires.
And they're getting a lot of criticism when they turn off those lines, too. I think the danger of putting everything on PG&E isn't that PG&E is particularly good at their job. They're not. But that we miss the larger point that there's a lot of moving pieces. And if you concentrate on one, you're not going to be able to fix it.
What are the moving pieces we're missing?
One of them is obviously climate change. the fire season, which has existed in California for longer than humans have existed at all, is a little longer and deeper than it was before the climate started changing. But there was a lot of resilience in the ecosystem for that fire season before we started a policy of 100 years of fire suppression. It's tough for people to kind of think, okay, we're just going to light this area on fire that's going to help thin the forests in the proper way, the way they were before humans got here. The same way, it's been really tough for people to say, we're going to cut power in order to save lives, even though cutting power threatens lives. As the mayor of Paradise said, it's kind of a no-win situation. Mm-hmm. The forests aren't correct for California. They're full of invasive species. They're stressed out by their density. There's all sorts of factors going on there that create a tinderbox in a place that's already prone to burn. And then people move into what's called the wildland-urban interface, and they probably just shouldn't be there. In the same way that we probably should stop building on floodplains, we probably mm-hmm. should stop building on places that naturally are going to burn down.
You say that all over coastal America, anyone building a small seawall is just miring in technical debt.
Yes. I don't want to say there are probably specific cases where a small seawall is called for, but in general, if people are still building on a coast that is threatened by sea level rise, unless they're building in a way that resists the ocean, which you can do, but almost nobody has done in America, then you're just going to get washed away.
So you've called California the perfect microcosm, but part of your point is that we need to zoom out. So where else are we in deep technical debt?
I would say one of the things you can look at is just the map of Louisiana. Like a third of the state isn't there anymore, because we haven't done anything to shore up that coastline, and we've continued to exploit resources in that area in a way that doesn't allow for natural resources to shore it up themselves. The trees that would lock in the land aren't there anymore. And the natural thing that happens is the Gulf of Mexico creeps in and takes over more of Louisiana. It's a very expensive job. We probably can't or don't want to save all of that land, but we aren't choosing. We're just kind of letting it happen and keeping that big old boot that we're so familiar with on our political map.
One thing I love about your use of the term technical debt is something you just alluded to. When we're saying we're deferring spending on infrastructure, it suggests that we've chosen not to act on it. But your phrase applied here, technical debt, implies that choosing not to spend on infrastructure is, in fact, in itself, a palpable action. It's actually borrowing big time. You've chosen to go into debt.
Yes. We are definitely acting through inaction here. Or in some cases, we're acting counter to what needs to happen. We aren't just deferring something. We're buying our future. We're deciding what kind of future we want to live in. We are living with the decisions in California that were made 100 years ago by people who didn't want to deal with the system they were in, or in some cases didn't understand the system they were in. I mean, much of our technical debt around the globe comes from not really understanding how the world worked. But we understand a lot more now.
Let's talk about some of that technical debt around the world. There's Jakarta, for instance. You said it's easy to drill for water there until the city sinks rather than figure out water policy. Where else do you see the bills coming due?
The slashing and burning of forests in Indonesia and Brazil. We're cutting down old growth forests without thinking about how we're going to replace the services those forests were providing. They set up the weather patterns of the world. We're not thinking about what that's going to do to rain. We're not thinking about what that's going to do to carbon or biodiversity. There is an effort right now to handle some of the technical debt that is coming from climate change along the edge of the Sahara, an area called the Sahel, mm-hmm. where they're trying to do replanting in order to kind of stop the spread of that desert and keep the land below it healthy and good for generating all sorts of exports and living services, food and water and all that. One of the reasons the Sahara is spreading is that as the planet gets warmer, deserts get bigger. We're actually pulling water out of aquifers beneath the Sahara, too, to try and maintain life in that area. It's growing that desert, and it's spreading down into this region where hundreds of millions of people live. Africa didn't release that carbon, but they're going to try and pay that down in the spot that they're in.
We've got short-term and long-term. We have levees and, closer to my home, subways falling apart.
And a seawall that needs to get built.
Roads, bridges, tunnels.
Yep.
So what are the biggest contributors to technical debt?
Short-term thinking and compartmentalized thinking. So when you're the legislature in New York State and you want some money for a thing you're looking at right now and you want to take it from the MTA, you're not really thinking about the whole system. So we need to go from a short-term niche mind frame to a systems thinking mind frame. And I think that's really difficult in contemporary politics.
And what about class and race? I was just thinking of the water in Flint, whereas the water in a different district wasn't tainted in nearly the same way.
Yeah, yeah. When we're thinking in these very narrow ways, we're going to prioritize in narrow ways. And that's why we decide these people aren't as important, putting one person ahead of another rather than saying, okay, what does a water system need to look like?
The irony is that in favoring the powerful and the wealthy, you've actually condemned
everyone. Yeah. By thinking of, like, I'm going to privilege this system above this system, you don't get the benefit of realizing there's not two systems there. There's one.
Why did you write this article?
Because I think that we really need to start framing this differently. I despair that our contemporary politics can in any way deal with the challenge that this century presents us. We tend to say, these are the things that are happening. They're discrete events, and now we have to rank how important they are. And everything about that framework is wrong. You know, Jakarta and the fires in the Amazon and the fires in California and all these different things, they are fundamentally part of the same system. They are part of the way that we have engineered our lives on this planet. Until we see that as one system, if I go back to the software metaphor, it's a guy fixing his little bit of the iPhone code who doesn't care what happens to the rest of the iPhone code. And that's how you get like a huge bug in the iOS system that's going to have to be emergency updated in a month.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of technical debt, are we heading to a place where perhaps Google or Amazon or Apple or Microsoft or Facebook, they have their own fixes, but they're proprietary? And as we increasingly rely on them, we'll have areas where things just fall apart, the center doesn't hold?
Well, I think when we talk about natural systems, you don't get more than one operating system. So when the planet says no, you can't switch to, you know, the Martian operating system.
But we'll still be able to do that in the technical world.
Yes, the technical world is a world we built. But as powerful and amazing as humanity is, it's still constrained by this planet. And that needs to be how we think about how we build stuff.
Thank you, Quinn.
Thank you very much for having me.
Quinn Norton writes for EmptyWheel.net. Her piece is titled, A World We Built to Burn.
Coming up, a toxic website runs aground, but is fighting for another chance to befoul the internet. Can it be stopped? Does it really matter?
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 8chan has been offline since August. You probably haven't noticed, but then I'm guessing 8chan was never meant for you. It's a dark hellscape of a website.
Now, 8chan is one of the 5,000 or so largest websites on the internet. And I would describe 8chan and other similar sites as almost a 24-hour-a-day Klan or neo-Nazi rally.
And for years, people on those sites said that the racism that they posted was basically just a game, where the winner is whoever posts the most offensive thing possible.
These communities have been able to organize harassment campaigns, as well as share the personal information of their enemies, people's addresses, credit card numbers.
The Notorious Anonymous Forum played host to the worst of the Gamergate trolls, alt-right hate groups, and pernicious conspiracy theories like Pizzagate, about a cabal of Democrats running a child sex ring out of a pizza parlor. But in 2019, 8chan finally hit the skids when the shooters at the Christchurch Mosque in New Zealand and those behind the Poway, California synagogue shooting and the El Paso, Texas Walmart shooting each used 8chan to spread their manifestos. That's when the cybersecurity firm servicing 8chan backed away.
The website security and network provider Cloudflare says it will no longer provide support to the website 8chan. That's where the suspected gunman in Saturday's attack posted a four-page manifesto just minutes before opening fire in a Walmart. More than 20 people were killed.
Hackers swarmed the now unprotected servers of 8chan following the August El Paso shooting, forcing the site offline. But this has been a month of feverish activity for the small group of 8chan administrators anxious to launch a new site with a different name, which raises crucial questions. Can 8chan stay dead? Does the saga of 8chan offer insights into the mechanics of digital media and how it enables bad actors to lethally overheat the so-called national conversation? Our producer, Micah Loewinger, is on it.
I'm fairly confident 8chan would be back up and running right now, if not for one social media activist.
I know that if 8chan comes back, it's only a matter of time before there is another 8chan-connected shooting. And that's what drives me to do all this.
That's Frederick Brennan, the founder of 8chan and now its most vocal critic. By pressuring web companies like Cloudflare to deny their services to the relaunch, he has attracted an onslaught of attacks from 8chan's devotees. Can I read one of the messages that you posted?
Sure, go ahead.
It says, "You're a pathetic, fat, disgusting little misshaped afterbirth that should have been slammed against a wall seconds after birth." It obviously goes on, and it gets more gruesome. You are subjecting yourself to, I imagine, quite a bit of emotional distress.
Yes, there is emotional abuse, and, you know, a lot of them have been trolling me nonstop, even drawing pictures of me being thrown down the stairs, which would be lethal due to my disability.
Brennan, who is 25 years old, was born with brittle bone disease. The white nationalists, conspiracy theorists, all the people trolling him now, all used to hang out with him on 8chan.
I know that these people are living pathetic, sad lives if they're sending me that kind of stuff. I know that that's true because, you know, I was a kind of person who didn't have anything going for them in life.
You were 19 when you started 8chan, right?
Yeah, that's right. Everybody knows the famous story where I was like on a mushroom trip and I was coming down, and that's when I came up with the idea for like a 4chan and Reddit combined. It sounded really good to me while I was in that state.
But obviously, hallucinogens, and he used them a lot when he was living at his mom's house in Atlantic City after ditching high school, didn't cause the 8chan we know today. Its potent brand of toxicity took time to develop. It started with Gamergate and 8chan's spiritual precursor, 4chan. In 2014, 4chan banned the discussions of a group of angry male gamers who used the forum to terrorize female cultural critics who wrote about sexism in the gaming industry. Steve Bannon nudged those trolls into the alt-right, and Fred Brennan gave them sanctuary on 8chan, he says, to boost traffic.
I used them, basically. We forged this unholy alliance, and I was kind of aware of the political arguments that image board users make about free speech. You know, that it's all just about the marketplace of ideas and the best ideas fall out. As 8chan's admin, I never saw any good ideas fall out. I just saw each community getting more and more extreme in their rhetoric.
Brennan incubated a cesspool of racist rhetoric and harassment campaigns, and he only removed material that blatantly broke U.S. laws. Brennan told me that he had little at stake in this free speech experiment because all the legal liability fell
on 8chan's eccentric middle-aged owner and financier, Jim Watkins. He and Watkins were so close that Brennan moved to Watkins' neighborhood in the Philippines, where both still live. But then their relationship soured.
With 8chan getting more and more radical, he basically admitted that he didn't care if it made money or not. He just likes the infamy that it brings him. And he had always said that his plan was to try to monetize it. So that came as a surprise. I just felt like he was acting in a very weird way, and I did not want to be around him. So I resigned in 2018, and lo and behold, the Christchurch shooting happened 3 months later.
Police are working to identify the bodies of the 50 people killed during an attack by a heavily armed gunman on two mosques in Christchurch, New Zealand, on March 15th.
The accused shooter announced his grim intentions on the controversial message board 8chan.
But, you know, I figured, all right, let's see if they'll clean up their act, and they didn't. After that shooting, they kept their slogan, Embrace Infamy, and then happened the Poway shooting, and then happened the El Paso shooting.
The suspected gunman in Poway posted praise for 8chan just before the shooting, saying, I've only been lurking for a year and a half, yet what I've learned here is priceless. It's been an honor.
There are some clues emerging in the aftermath of the shooting in El Paso, Texas. The suspect there posted a manifesto on the website 8chan moments before the shooting.
This week, the family of a woman killed in the El Paso shooting filed a lawsuit against the alleged 21-year-old killer, his parents, his grandparents, Jim Watkins, the CEO of 8chan's former cybersecurity provider Cloudflare, and Brennan. But the lawyers face a considerable hurdle. Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that says that websites are not responsible for the content posted by their users. Brennan thinks that the lawsuit against him is, quote, bogus. He says he was just an employee at 8chan, and he points to his recent activism against the site.
I believe victims of radicalization who say that they were radicalized on 8chan. And I'm sorry to them that I made, you know, a website where they were radicalized. I clearly did not recognize the harm that I was doing and the harm that sites like 8chan do.
I can't tell if you're fighting it because you're disturbed by what it's become, or if you're just really upset with this person you used to work with.
Well, why can't it be both? I understand why I'm a complicated figure. Preventing more 8chan-connected shootings is the main reason. But it is also true that I have a dislike for Jim Watkins.
Watkins declined our request for comment. Almost 2 months after it went offline, 8chan tweeted out a video. An anarchic black flag ripples in the rain. A new logo emerges in a flash of lightning. It reads, 8kun. Brennan says the name 8kun is intended to herald a more mature site. Chan, in Japanese, means child, but kun means young adult. He doesn't buy it.
I don't believe they've changed. I believe that it's the same as it's always been. Get as much infamy as possible for Jim Watkins. This nonsensical 8kun rebrand, and it just made me really angry, and I decided I'm going to do whatever I can to get it shut down.
Watkins reassured followers on a far-right podcast that the new site would be more secure.
We'll have less points of failure. Nobody in America would do business with us.
So he looked for help overseas, first with a British web company called Zaire.
They tried to get on it like 4 or 5 times, and I got them kicked off each time.
How did you do that?
I just lit a fire under certain journalists that I knew, and I tweeted at Zaire, kept including their name, sent them some information. They reviewed it, and then boom, they took them offline.
So 8kun tried elsewhere, including the giant Chinese internet service providers Tencent and Alibaba.
Tweeted.
When those fell through, Watkins turned to Selectel, a web hosting firm in Russia where 8chan was officially banned in 2015.
Tweeted.
So far, Brennan and other social media activists have kept 8chan on the run. But the game is far from over because there's another dark wrinkle to the 8chan 8kun story. Another reason why Brennan is racing the clock to keep the site offline.
Tom Rydell, Jim Watkins' main lieutenant, told me that their main focus is getting the QAnon people back. And we all know that QAnon is a ridiculous scam.
Who is Q? What is QAnon? And why should it concern us at all?
Okay, the big questions.
Mike Rothschild, conspiracy theory debunker and contributor to the Daily Dot.
QAnon is a conspiracy theory
that holds that a Trump administration insider with access to highly classified military intelligence is leaving clues to an upcoming purge of the deep state by using the message board 8chan to deliver riddles and prompts and out-of-context pictures that followers will decode so they know what's really going on.
I saw a story about this QAnon Bible shooting up to the top 20 Amazon bestsellers list.
Yeah.
Outranking authors like F. Scott Fitzgerald and Dr. Seuss. Anonymously written, the book contains a compilation of unproven radical conspiracy theories suggesting high-ranking Democrats are part of a cult that eats children, claiming the government created AIDS and saying it's also behind the movie Monsters, Inc.
Oh, there was also that one murder in the name of QAnon.
Yeah, the mob boss allegedly shot dead on Staten Island by the young man who drew the letter Q on his hand along with some Q catchphrases. QAnon is a philosophy that revolves around extrajudicial violence. The entire idea of this event they call the Storm or the Great Awakening is essentially a massive unsealing of tens of thousands of indictments against basically every prominent liberal in every field of industry, and that they will all be taken into custody by some kind of militia force that answers to nobody, and then they'll be tried in the field, and then they'll either be sent to Guantanamo Bay or they'll be executed. You can't tell people that there is a pedophilic cabal running every aspect of their life and at some point not expect someone to do something about it.
You'd probably think the impeachment inquiry would be red meat for the QAnon crowd. And yet, we haven't heard a single word from its anonymous heart and hero, its spinner of theories, the person known only as Q. He's silent. Why?
He had so much faith in the untouchability and invincibility of 8chan that he tied himself to it with iron chains.
Q, the real Q, whoever he or she or they are, was tired of all the impersonators on sites like Reddit and 4chan feeding off of its mystery and sapping its power. So Q vowed to prophesy on 8chan only. But 8chan is no more. Q has buried itself alive.
I find it absolutely hilarious. It's all his fault, and there's no way that the Q believers can, like, even start a new Q because it would just break the entire mythology. It would be saying that Q is so weak that a disabled man in the Philippines can take down his home just by sending a few emails, and the entire U.S. military intelligence operation is not powerful enough to stop me, right? This is why it's so important that we don't let them get online. If 8chan comes back for even a few hours, Q can move. Q can post a cryptographic key.
And with that code, followers can find the true Q wherever he wants to post. And Brennan says that could happen soon. Late in my reporting, I learned that Jim Watkins had struck a deal with Vanwa Tech, a new U.S.-based cybersecurity company run by its CEO and only employee, Nick Lim.
I've been doing this stuff for over a decade, but Vanwa Tech itself is a relatively new company.
You said over a decade?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Just because you sound kind of young, and the picture I saw of you online, you seemed like you were like in your mid-20s or something.
Yeah, I'm 22 right now, but I mean, I've been running businesses since I'm about 8 years old, just to pay for my bills and all that.
Wow, okay. Are you familiar with the context for why your old company, BitMitigate, and now a number of other companies were not willing to do business with 8chan?
Yeah, I'm not. I mean, I've never been to the website before. I don't really know much about it. In fact, when I got them as my client, that was like the first time that I heard about them, and also when they got dropped.
When did you acquire them as a client?
Probably within the last month.
So it's been a month, but you haven't read any articles about 8chan or talked to anyone else in the cybersecurity web infrastructure community about the drama surrounding the website?
Yeah, I just try to stay away from drama.
Several days after our conversation, Lim tweeted, "8kun will be back and stronger than ever." So maybe Lim will be providing security to enable the launch of 8kun. What does that mean for Q? If Q can post his key on 8kun, even briefly, he can go anywhere. But what if 8kun never launches? could you really kill his conspiracy theory by getting rid of his platform? I asked Brennan whether he thought this strategy of deplatforming could effectively curb the power of QAnon and other extreme ideologies.
Everything is a short-term solution, and these people will always find a way. They have a lot of legal protection on their side in the United States. Stopping people from being radicalized for a few months, I think, is a victory. Young men all over the United States are not being exposed to some of the propaganda on 8chan, and they will not grow up with that in their lives. So I would say that even if it's not a total long-term solution, that doesn't mean to not try.
The virtual disappearance of right-wing troll Milo Yiannopoulos and conspiracy peddler Alex Jones, thrown off of Twitter and YouTube respectively, demonstrates that deplatforming works. But those are individuals, not communities. Some researchers of the far right say that shutting off sites like 8chan is like putting a band-aid on a bullet wound. But at a time when our politicians seem unwilling to enact policies that would curb mass violence, if internet companies want to take greater responsibility, it's worth a try. For On the Media, I'm Micah Loewinger.
Coming up, a major regional media outlet grapples with the right of citizens to be forgotten, at least in internet searches.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. If the story about 8chan is a tale of bad actors with worse intentions, this next piece is the mirror opposite. It emerged a few months back when Radiolab reporter Molly Webster was searching for stories and, being from Ohio, naturally checked out the website cleveland.com. There she found a piece about the site's own experiment in applying what's known as, quote, the right to be forgotten. Using a complex and evolving set of criteria, cleveland.com was trying to determine who has the right to have stories about them deleted so that they don't come up in internet searches in perpetuity. Intrigued, Molly called up Chris Quinn, whose byline had been on the story. Quinn had started out at the Cleveland Plain Dealer as a reporter, and then became an editor, and then in 2013, the head of an entirely new newsroom. Molly takes it from here.
He basically became the editor-in-chief of their online paper, Cleveland.com.
What we really were trying to do was figure out what kind of content does the digital audience want.
The audience was different. The format was different. The speed at which they had to put up stories was different. But there was one part of the online process that stuck out to him, and it had to do with time and memory.
Yeah, I think it was in 2014 when I first wrote about it.
Back in the day, if you did something stupid, got arrested, and ended up in the paper, people would read it in the morning, and then they'd throw it out.
And it drops out of sight. I mean, there's some newspapers that kept indexes that would be at the library.
And if someone really wanted to find it, they'd probably have to spend hours or days just scrolling through microfiche slides to discover that thing about you from your past. But now that everything is online, it's there.
Right up front, forever.
So as Cleveland.com started putting up all these stories about people driving drunk or vandalizing property or streaking across the football field, Chris started getting these emails.
Requests from people to take down stories about them.
I made a big mistake, owed up to it, and paid for it.
The situation has had a horrific effect on myself and my entire family.
Because they're embarrassed or it hurts their ability to get jobs.
These stories have come up in every job interview I've had in the last 5 years.
We were crushing them psychologically.
I'm just in a corner and don't know what to do.
It didn't feel good. But there was a long-standing feeling that we're the first version of history and that these archives are sacrosanct and you would never change them. Every month, I'd get more of these requests from somebody saying, your story is wrecking my life, imploring you to help them overcome a mistake.
So Chris made an announcement. This was the column that I read, and it said something like, you know, if you've had an article written about you, and it was by us, and you want it taken down or your name deleted or something, send us an email and we'll consider it. And I just thought, who has a right to be forgotten? And for reasons I don't entirely understand, he just said, why don't you just come see for yourself?
We talk it out. Just acknowledging this continues to be very much an experiment.
So that brings me into the room.
Hey, I'm Molly Webster.
They meet about once a month. When I visited, there were seven people in the room. There was the special projects manager, the social media editor, the public advocacy manager, a crimes editor, a former rock critic who is now the head of the culture desk, and a sports editor.
You're
David.
Okay.
We all sit around a long table.
We're not going to name the people as we talk about them. We'll just use the numbers for the cases. Well,
yeah. And everyone has in front of them this document that's about 50 pages. It has 12 different cases outlined, and each case has got the articles attached to it, the statement of the person about what they want removed. Is it a name or a mugshot? And a personal plea for why they want it taken down.
Are we ready to start?
Yes.
All right, so
this is an attorney that did plea to a misdemeanor and did have it expunged. I mean, this would seem to me to be a no-brainer.
He pleaded guilty to obstruction of justice.
A misdemeanor charge of obstruction of justice.
Quick note, for a morass of legal and ethical reasons, we are going to try to keep all the people we talk about anonymous, so you're going to hear a number of bleeps.
You have no context, you don't know what, and he's had the record expunged.
He's pleaded guilty to something.
Yeah, but he's saying... You
know. They started getting in these arguments about how much value an article had and whether or not it was serving a public good.
We need to put names because it's part of the public record.
This is Kelly McBride. She's an ethicist at the Poynter Institute.
I did have this experience where my kid was on a soccer team and there was this coach who seemed really questionable to me in the way that he acted around the kids. And sure enough, on the mugshot site in my local hometown, this guy showed up for domestic violence.
Ooh.
So I went to the athletic director and I was like, hey, this guy can't be working for us. And that's the use that journalists point to. You should be able to find out the bad information about somebody because you might be considering employing this person around your children.
Or employing them at all. Is this thing the lawyer did bad enough that all of us need to know about it?
If I'm one of his customers, I would probably want to know that. But... he's still licensed to practice law, right? The bar here, I mean, they're pretty thorough about deciding whether somebody is fit to practice law.
You can hear them putting a lot of weight on whether or not a court has sealed or expunged a record.
The court said, yes, you've done your time, you can have it sealed. We would need a very strong argument here not to do that. You want to make your argument stronger, Laura?
All right, I mean, no, I guess.
In the end, they decided that this lawyer had the right to be forgotten, and so they just sort of like vanished his name from the article. And that was one of the simpler ones. Like, after that, things definitely got tougher because some of the cases were so complicated, like someone who killed somebody, and then it was labeled self-defense. That's still killing somebody. Does that person have the right to be forgotten? And then one of the hardest cases...
All right, on the fourth one, he did have it expunged.
Was actually a cop. His record was sealed.
But it is a police officer.
Over the course of a few years, he lied on his timesheet and walked away with thousands of dollars.
We've said on the front end of this that sex crimes, violence crimes, and corruption were much less likely to do this. So... would you view this as corruption or more as a theft in office kind of thing?
The cop said basically, look, I've been on the force for many years. This was just one mistake.
This was not some elected official. This was not use of force. I mean, this guy was skimming overtime. But when the firefighters were having time stuff too, I mean, that was a big problem. But this is one guy doing one thing. I'm so back and forth on this one.
He didn't abuse his authority as an officer. I mean, this is like any other theft.
Yeah, but I hold him to a higher standard for being a cop.
You could see people's just like opinion shift.
This was not a momentary lapse in judgment. This went on for like years.
And I'm with Mark. The public trust issue here, you know, this isn't some water department guy skimming copper off the job site. Like, this is a police officer stealing overtime over the course of years.
I don't know. I first read this and I was like, yes, I think we should let him be forgotten. But now I'm kind of on the other side. He's not a public threat But because he is in a public position, he should be held to a higher standard.
Well, get back to our central question. Is the value of having his name there greater than the pain it's causing him for being there?
Again and again, Chris just steered the conversation back to that question. But how do you know what information will be valuable in the future?
I mean, what stops him from going to get a job? If he gets it sealed and this story goes away, other offices might not be.
I wonder if he lost his certifications.
We should look that up. Because if, I mean, we're talking about another Tamir Rice case.
That's 12-year-old Tamir Rice waving a...
Hovering over the conversation was what happened to Tamir Rice.
12-year-old Tamir Rice...
holding a toy gun.
So in 2014, in Cleveland, police officers shot and killed Tamir Rice after they saw him holding a toy gun.
The two policemen said that Rice was warned three times to show his hands, but no bystander heard that or any warning before the shots.
I did not know this, but the cop who shot and killed Tamir Rice, before he worked in Cleveland, he worked at another police department where he was deemed unfit to serve. And then when the Cleveland Police Department was hiring him, they didn't dig into his records, and then the other police department didn't, like, offer the records. And since it had never been a news story that was Googleable, like, no one knew about it, so he was hired.
If all records of this disappear and he applies to be a cop again, it would be basically our fault that he's able to do bad things.
And so, in this case, one of the thoughts in the room is,
what if one of these people in a future year does something horrendous, right? Wouldn't you want to know about their past transgressions?
I actually talked about this with Chris in one of our interviews.
I mean, wouldn't that make those past transgressions relevant again?
And he told me that when they do decide to delete someone...
we're keeping a spreadsheet of the names that we've taken out.
Wow, that feels like a crazy, powerful spreadsheet.
Yeah, I know.
Is it in a vault or something?
Look, I keep saying this is an experiment, and we're not there yet.
With Timesheet Cop Guy, once Tamir Rice walked into the room, you could kind of feel the energy shift to the non-deletion side. So they just wrapped it up, decided not to delete him, and then it was like, on to the next case.
Newsrooms are tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to deal with this.
That's Poynter ethicist Kelly McBride again.
Because there are thousands and thousands of people who did one stupid thing, and that is the thing that the internet remembers them for.
It is a huge conversation happening now because of something that's like bubbling up in Europe. In Spain, this guy, Mario, in 1998, he had basically gone into bankruptcy, at which point the local newspaper published an announcement about it. And then 10 years go by. Mario cleaned up, got his money back, got his life back on course. And so he reaches out to the newspaper and he was like, hey, I've cleaned up my life. Can you take this bulletin down so it doesn't show up on the internet?
Mm-hmm.
And the newspaper says no. And then he goes to Google and he says, hey, can you delist this from your search engines? And they say no. And so, long story short, he actually takes Google to court. Gets all the way up to the European Union Court, which is like the Supreme Court of the European Union. And in 2014, the judges make a decision that if something is out of date, irrelevant, or not accurate, a person can request a search engine to take it down. A new right is established. This is when you start to hear the phrase right to be forgotten.
The unfortunate element of human remembering is that because our brain forgets automatically, we never had to deal with deliberate forgetting.
This is Victor.
Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, professor of internet governance, Oxford University. We can't deliberately forget. If I tell you, please forget that my second name is Michael, you will remember that. And so the problem is we don't know how to disregard memories of our past. We don't know how to forgive if we remember. And so as we become a remembering society, we become an unforgiving society.
So he is a strong proponent of policies that help us forget, even just a little bit.
I'm not in favor of annihilating memories. I'm in favor of putting them in the shoebox and stashing them in the attic. So that if you really want to make the effort to go up there, you can take them down, pour yourself a glass of wine and go through them. But you don't stumble over them every day.
All right, this is a good one. It's college kid who got involved in...
So one of the cases that Chris and the other editors talked about while I was there was this college student who got involved in a drug operation.
It is college kid doing something very, very stupid. But, I mean, it's going to dog him for the rest of his life if it stays on our site. Everybody knows about it. Yeah, but this is a college kid doing something really bad. I mean, he was enabling people to do drugs. Years later, he's trying to get on with his life.
So the first thought you hear in the room is just, oh, my God, we were all idiots in college. We should take these articles down.
I didn't have an issue with this one, but if somebody does, speak up. I mean,
but then on the other side...
There is something to me that's different between and, you know, selling pot on the side when you're in college or something and getting caught for it.
He is getting it expunged. I mean, the other thing we could do is say, when your expungement's complete, let us know and we'll take it down. But it's years later. He was in college. He was 25. He wasn't like he was 18.
So remove the fact that this is a clean-cut kid who was going to a private college. Move this scenario to the same age, the same race, but not in college and in some rural community.
And at this point, questions of race and class come into the room. All the editors are white. Most went to college themselves. Is that biasing them in some way?
Would our willingness to forgive this kid be different if the social economic issue changes here?
This isn't about forgiveness. It's about the idea that on our site, because we're so big, when you search for somebody, this is the first thing you find. And we haven't set any kind of economic strata for this. We haven't set a geographic strata. We're considering each case as it comes in. Does this kid deserve to have his name removed?
As you heard, Chris reacted pretty abruptly to the word forgiveness.
I think it's almost presumptuous for me to think that I can forgive these people.
But in a sense, you've taken on, if we acknowledge these people and offer them respite, we'll help the rest of the world do that too. That to me sounds like forgiveness.
I don't feel like we're forgiving the 7 people who asked for this relief. I feel like we're enabling them to carry on with their lives without the baggage of the mistakes they made, because society is very judgmental. I think what we can do is kind of revert back to the way things worked before the internet.
Well, if we think the answer to this is to unpublish everything that somehow we collectively think ought to be unpublished, that is a pipe dream.
I ran Chris's thought by Deborah Dwyer, who is a doctoral student at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill.
School of Media and Journalism.
She has been studying journalists, how they're approaching takedown requests in this whole, like, right to be forgotten issue. And basically what she told me is, you can only delete so much.
We're never going to be able to eradicate our past. That ship has sailed. But organizations I talked to said they were considering not covering arrests or court cases, actual trials, unless they could see them through their completion. There's never going to be a perfect way to clean up everyone's past. We've got to learn to live with it. And if we can decide maybe that we ought to address it with a little bit of compassion, that gives me hope.
We're not doing that one. I'm looking for one of the simple ones, just the delete.
Yeah, for a delete.
Here's one.
Okay. So this is just deleting like a 2-sentence paragraph maybe, or one right. Sentence paragraph that just says his name, this guy's name.
So I had a note at the top.
This story was updated to remove someone's name in accordance with the Cleveland.com right to be forgotten policy.
And hit save. And it's gone.
Molly Webster reported this piece for Radiolab. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Mike Lowinger, Leah Fetter, John Hanrahan, and Asa Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.